The Tom Woods Show, episode 1585.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, I don't know about you, but I am running into a lot of progressives saying, look, police, fire, schools, these are all great examples of socialism. Well, let's focus on that school example. I've got a free ebook called Education Without the State that makes a pretty darn good case for a stateless approach to education. Pick it up at nostateeducation.com. Hi, everybody. Tom Woods here, talking a little bit about socialism today because I want to build on what I did in episode 1583, because I think I left a little bit of stuff out in emphasizing just how fundamental Mises' critique of socialism is. And it's not to say that there aren't other things you could say about socialism too, but these other things are entirely secondary to what Mises had to say. Before I jump into that, I want to point something out that I've not said yet. I guess I just posted it on Twitter. But most of you listening know that Bob Murphy and I host a podcast called Contra Krugman, partly because I played you a sample episode just yesterday in episode 1584. And chances are then, if you know that podcast, you also know about the cruise that Bob and I have hosted. This will be the fifth year in a row we have hosted the so-called Contra Cruise. And it is a ton of fun because why wouldn't it be? And we do just fun, hilarious things and play games. And also, you know, we do some learning, but we have outings and excursions and parties and music. And it's just tremendous. Everybody loves it. You do not leave the Contra Cruise saying, boy, that was a waste of my time. No. There's a reason we get so many repeat customers, because it's such a great experience. And this year, this is not the announcement's coming in a second. This is stuff you already know. We got Phil Labonte from the metal band All That Remains. We got Dave Smith, the comedian and podcaster. And we have Scott Horton, the great libertarian foreign policy specialist, all of whom are joining us as special guests. So it's going to be a tremendous time. So you got to get over there. You get a special bonus if you're an early bird registrant. But what I want to say is there will be no Contra Cruise in 2021. This is not some cheap marketing tactic, fake scarcity to get you to join us this year. This is absolutely the case. And this is just for a number of reasons pertaining to Bob's life and my life and schedules and stuff. There will be no Contra Cruise in 2021. So if you've been thinking about joining us, this is your year. And obviously, it's your year. I mean, why would you not want to go on the one that has Dave Smith and Scott Horton? I mean, I don't know the answer to that question. So make sure you reserve your, and you know, the sooner you reserve your cabin, the more you can assure yourself that you won't be, you know, at the far end of the ship with the, you know, with loud noises all the time. I mean, you want to, if you've booked cruises before, you want to book them early to get the most desirable spot. So make sure and do that. The website is contracruise.com, and we will very much look forward to seeing you on board. Let's jump into some material here. When people talk about socialism and critics of socialism address the subject, they come at it from a number of angles that will be familiar to most people. The Ludwig von Mises objection to socialism is not familiar to most people. And yet it is the most fundamental and crushing objection of all. Now, I'll review that objection with you in a little while, just to refresh your memory. But what I want to do is just talk about a few things that people might say about socialism that are absolutely true and that can be great supplemental arguments and that can be useful arguments for people who, frankly, can't comprehend Mises' argument. I mean, maybe they don't, I mean, let's just talk between you and me here. Maybe they don't have literally the mental capacity to do it. And so these simpler arguments may work with those people. So one of the objections, of course, is that in a system of socialism where there isn't necessarily absolute income equality, but there are movements in that direction. There's certainly an egalitarian ethos that runs through the whole system. There will be less of an incentive for people to do really hard, difficult work. Because if they're just going to be compensated more or less the same as people doing comfortable work, why wouldn't they want to do comfortable work? How are you going to get people to do the dirty work of society? You know, what? Because right now, those jobs carry some sort of a premium. you know, to get people to do the dirty work. Like, for example, taking out the garbage. Rothbard used to give this as an example. Okay, you earn a little bit more taking out the garbage than you do as a cashier at 7-Eleven. Now, being a cashier at 7-Eleven has its own set of challenges, I grant you. But in some ways, it is more pleasant than taking out the garbage. Although, going to show the way the market provides, I find that the people who pick up my garbage have to do far, far less dirty work than ever before. Because I have a special, everybody in our development has a special kind of trash bin that corresponds with the special mechanical arm of the truck that the company providing the service to us uses. So the truck goes by, this mechanical arm picks up the trash can, dumps out the contents into the truck, puts the trash can back down and drives along. There's no need for there to be some guy riding along on the end of the truck, getting himself filthy, touching garbage all day. So even that has improved. You know, isn't that something? Anyway, I marvel at things like this all the time. I also marvel at it because sometimes they decide they want to pick up the garbage right when I'm recording the blankety blank Tom Woods show, and it's making a racket outside my window. So yeah, I've looked out the window and noticed the new technology because of that. So, all right, so getting back to what might be called the incentive problem, what incentive would people have to do this difficult or otherwise undesirable work if there aren't differential compensations for different forms of work? And the significance of this problem, vis-a-vis Mises, is that he expressly stipulated that his critique of socialism would work. Well, let me rephrase that because it's been so long, I can't be sure that he expressly, but let's just say it is strongly, strongly implied in the logic of his argument that it makes no difference if we're dealing with human beings who need to be compensated extra to do undesirable work or robots who have no emotions or preferences. Or even if we were dealing with a human race that had been systematically brainwashed into just performing whatever tasks society gave them, the Mises critique of socialism would be unaffected. Unaffected. He is still arguing that socialism cannot work in the classical sense of not Denmark, not Sweden, which are market economies with heavy welfare states. He's talking about socialism as envisioned by Marx, where there is collective and non-private ownership of the means of production. In that setup, it does not matter whether or not you're dealing with people who maybe will do anything you tell them. The question is, what do you tell them to do? And as we'll see in a little while, the socialist planner has nothing to tell them to do. No non-arbitrary thing to tell them to do, that is. There's no way he can know what the best, most value-productive use of this labor is. So we'll get to that toward the end. So that's one thing. Now, another related problem would be the same kind of problem that emerges in welfare states, heavy welfare states, that the more attractive the welfare state is, the more people will, in effect, drop out of the labor force and simply receive government benefits. And so as the state becomes more, let's say, generous in its awarding of these benefits, you get an ever larger group of people wanting to receive them, sitting on top of an ever shrinking base of productive people, creating the wealth that can sustain them via the welfare state. And so you have this problem of an increasing number of hands reaching out for wealth and an ever diminishing base of wealth creators to generate that wealth. So that's another issue related to welfare states and to socialism. But again, this is not nearly as fundamental as the Misesian argument. Now, we can come up with more and more of these, but I think one of the ones that's been most common, or at least was common for a long time, had to do with dispersed knowledge. And this is the approach that F.A. Hayek took, particularly in his essay, The Use of Knowledge in Society. And I'm going to link to all this stuff, plus some articles related to the point that I'm making at tomwoods.com/1585. But the gist of the dispersed information problem or the knowledge problem was that the problem that would be faced by the Socialist Planning Board is that no one human mind could possibly be able to gather and, you know, in effect comprehend, but also just simply to gather all the relevant information, you know, all the knowledge you would need about society. Like, for example, just something trivial like these trucks that transport, you know, let's say product A from one place to another, then are returning completely empty 400 miles. And that seems like sort of a waste. So maybe we could find some way that on the way back, they could transport something else. Well, no planner is going to know about some empty trucks in Hoboken, you know, but a local person on the spot might know about that and might perceive an entrepreneurial opportunity. So you see, you think of something as trivial as that truck problem, and you multiply it by a country the size of the United States, and you see that no planner could come anywhere near amassing the staggering amount of information he would need to be able to make a rational plan. And so the whole attempt is hopeless and impossible. And it would be the very sort of person who would think it was doable would be the last person on earth you would want doing it. So this is the gist of the argument, that therefore what we need is a system that is decentralized. Instead of one person somehow trying to gather all this information and come up with a coordinated plan, what we need is a system that can exploit people's local knowledge of local circumstances and local conditions and supplies and goods and all that, and take that information and run with it entrepreneurially. So instead of one big planner, let everybody individually make their own individual plans based on their own localized knowledge, because it's too difficult for any one central planner to gather up all that knowledge. So now that has things to be said for it and things to be said against it. But the trouble with it is, even this particular way of looking at it, I mean, there are a number of problems with it. I'm going to link to those on the show notes page. But the key thing is that Mises' critique is more fundamental even than that. Because Mises is willing to stipulate a world in which the central planner does have all that information. He said, let's suppose we had a central planner who really did know all this stuff. So in other words, this Hayek critique makes it seem like what we're facing is simply a really, really difficult, if not insurmountable, practical obstacle. Now, if that practical obstacle could be overcome, perhaps socialism would at least have a fighting chance. But it's just hopeless to imagine that you could overcome this problem. Well, Mises is going beyond that. He's saying it's not simply that we're faced with a really, really difficult practical problem. It's that we are dealing with an impossibility. And now you may say, oh, but these socialist systems lasted for a while, so they couldn't be strictly impossible. Well, first of all, it depends on what he means by impossible and what you mean by socialist systems. He is talking about socialism the way it was conceived of by Marx, where there is no private ownership of the means of production. And generally, in a lot of these so-called socialist societies, even the most oppressive ones, they realized early on that couldn't be done. So what you very often had was simply a very, 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 very interventionist market economy. But so interventionist, you almost wouldn't recognize it as a market economy. But you had a lot of that. Mises is saying if you had this, it would be not just a situation where you have a really tricky practical problem of gathering knowledge. It can't be done. And socialist economy is impossible in the sense that economy and economizing involve taking resources and making sure they are applied to their most value productive ends and the most value productive production processes. That's not possible to do in a socialist economy. And we'll get to that in a minute, exactly why that is. And why this is a more fundamental critique than we just don't have the knowledge. Before we do that, though, let me say a quick word about something I love. And speaking of knowledge, is something that will help you potentially both in your career and just in your private life, in your own individual interests. And that is my favorite platform in the world, Skillshare, which is an online learning community for creative people where millions come together to take the next step in their creative journey. It offers thousands of inspiring classes for all you creative and curious people out there, and on topics ranging from everything from illustration to design, photography, video, business, freelancing, and more. You can consume these courses anytime you want to, any time of day, and most of them are under 60 minutes with short lessons. As somebody who balances an awful lot of things every day, by the way, I can tell you that I have benefited from the Real Productivity, How to Build Habits That Last class taught by Thomas Frank. And guess what? You've got nothing to lose. Tom Woods Show listeners get 2 free months of Skillshare. You get access to all these thousands of classes for free for 2 months. Check it out at Skillshare.com/Woods and start that creative journey today. That's Skillshare.com/Woods. All right, let's get back to Mises. So again, Mises stipulates that we can have all the information in the minds of the planner, and yet he still can't tell people what to do in anything other than an arbitrary way. This goes to show that even if we're dealing with people who, as I mentioned in the incentive problem, are willing to do anything, we don't know what to tell them to do. And even if we're dealing with planners who have all the relevant so-called information, they don't know what to tell these people to do. And here's what Rothbard says. The uniqueness and the crucial importance of Mises' challenge to socialism is that it was totally unrelated to the well-known incentive problem. Mises, in effect, said, all right, suppose that the socialists have been able to create a mighty army of citizens all eager to do the bidding of their masters, the socialist planners. What exactly would those planners tell this army to do? How would they know what products to order their eager slaves to produce, at what stage of production, how much of the product at each stage, what techniques or raw materials to use in that production and how much of each, and where specifically to locate all this production? How would they know their costs or what process of production is or is not efficient? That's the thing. You can know all the stuff about where everything is and how much of it you have and how it interacts with each other, but what you can't know is precisely this, now what? If we have hundreds of millions of people, all of whom have preferences for products, and there are all different ways to produce those products, and if you just produce them arbitrarily, then you're going to be taking resources sort of at random to produce what everybody wants, but you'll be producing them in completely arbitrary ways. I mean, maybe the people over here have a much stronger demand for product A, and yet you're wasting resources that could have been used much more efficiently in the production of product A on something people don't need nearly as much. Then you have all these different forms of, you have labor and skilled labor that could go in all different directions. Well, should we have a labor-intensive firm or a more capital-intensive production process? Well, who knows? Well, how can we know which one is better? You can know if you have a market economy where other industries are able to bid workers away or bid capital away, then you see how much more urgently needed those things are elsewhere, and then you decide what you should do in your particular case so as to integrate your plans into all the individual plans of everybody else in the society. Where should your plant be located? Maybe everybody wants a plant located right here, right next to the beach. Everybody wants their plant located right there. So how are we going to decide who gets the plant located there? What, through politics? How would that get decided? Again, having knowledge, how does that, that's not the issue here. It's how do we take people's subjective preferences and somehow translate them into something objective that can help individual entrepreneurs figure out what they should do? Well, the objective thing is market prices. Market prices for the means of production cannot come about unless there's private property in the means of production. Because only then are the means of production bought and sold, and only then are they bought and sold by people with skin in the game so that you get a meaningful result, namely market prices. These market prices then allow entrepreneurs to appraise the current situation. They look at current prices. They use that as a factor in appraising what future prices are likely to be. And then they decide on all these micro questions about, okay, this should I locate here or there? Should I use more labor or more capital? If I use more capital, should I use this or that? In what quantities? And it's through this mechanism that all these individual entrepreneurial plans are coordinated. Because if you didn't have market prices in the means of production, well, then how could some other production process that more urgently needs something than you do bid it away from you? How else could they go into the market and say, well, we're willing to pay X dollars plus 100 to get this good? That's the way we make sure that people's preferences for consumer goods get expressed optimally, I hate to use that word, in the allocation of capital goods. Because if I desire some finished good, like a book, well, then all the technology that goes into making books, they get their value from the fact that I want the finished book. If suddenly people decided they didn't want books anymore, they didn't want any printed item, printing presses or whatever, you know, the modern equivalent is, would just lose their value. It's not that the book has value because the printing press was expensive and so the entrepreneur has to recoup his expenses and that's why the book costs whatever. No, it's the opposite. It's the printing press itself would have no value unless consumers wanted to buy the finished book. If nobody wants to buy the finished book, the printing press is worth nothing. So it's my desire for the book that ripples up through the capital structure, all the different stages of production. I am just one consumer. We have hundreds of millions of consumers in the United States alone, all of whom have preferences. And those preferences now have to be absorbed, have to be factored in to the way production takes place. Well, that can't be done unless there are prices, because then prices allow us to take all these hundreds of millions of individual preferences and somehow figure out an objective way to evaluate how to satisfy those preferences. We want to satisfy those preferences in ways that earn us a profit, because that is, in effect, society's way of saying you have arranged resources in a way that adds value. So keep on doing that. If I didn't have prices in the means of production, I couldn't evaluate if I was making a profit or not. So therefore, I couldn't evaluate whether or not I was deploying resources in ways that are consistent with the hundreds of millions of individual preferences out there, that we are making sure that people's preferences are satisfied to the extent humanly possible with the least possible waste, with the fewest opportunities foregone, that my production of X is not interfering with the production of Z that is also urgently demanded. All these infinite problems and difficulties are, let's say, if not completely resolved, extremely aided by the presence of market prices that allow entrepreneurs to make rational, non-arbitrary resource allocation decisions. Bob Murphy has an article where he talks about these ways of looking at the problem, knowledge versus economic calculation of profit and loss made possible by private property in the means of production, which yields prices in the means of production. He says this, let me try to motivate the point this way. When we use a thermometer to measure the temperature inside an oven in a commercial bakery, the device transmits information to us. There really is an objective fact of the matter, of the kinetic energy of the air molecules bouncing around inside the oven, and the thermometer is an imperfect way of translating that data to us in a form our minds can comprehend and incorporate into our decisions. But there's no doubt that the oven really has a temperature, regardless of our measuring it with a thermometer. In contrast, when we ask how much economic value does the oven possess, then that is a fundamentally different question. This isn't an objective fact that is embedded in the arrangement of matter. The question takes into account all of the subjective preferences of everyone on the planet, as well as their expectations about the possibility of transforming matter into different forms. It is a mind-boggling question, in fact, that can only be answered by setting up a market economy and then making informed guesses as to what people would be willing to pay for the oven. That's a kind of a difference between information, which is insufficient for the problem we're looking to solve here, and entrepreneurial appraisement, which is made possible by prices. Now, it doesn't guarantee that the entrepreneurs will be correct in their appraisements, because then no one would ever suffer losses. But it is an indispensable ingredient for entrepreneurs to be able to look at a latticework, an array of prices and price relationships as a fundamental starting point for anticipating what the future is going to hold and what that structure of prices is going to be in the future. And they make their decisions on that basis. If they did not have that basis on which to make their decisions, the decisions would all be arbitrary. They would all be random and arbitrary. And instead of an economy, per se, you would have chaotic series of absolutely ungrounded guesses and a completely chaotic allocation of resources, and therefore not even close to best satisfying the incredibly diverse array of consumer preferences. Now, that's a lot I'll grant you, that's a lot to wrap your head around. So I've got some articles up at tomwoods.com/1585 that I think you'll enjoy reading. All right, a quick note before we wrap up here. This is, in effect, promoting my own competition, but I'm very glad to do it because I want to help people who listen to this show. I want us to be an army of successful people. So dissectingliberty.com. I don't know how that was available. That's a really good one. Dissectingliberty.com is the website of the podcast Dissecting Liberty, which just got started within the past month. And they've already had episodes on a lot of key topics like the Iran situation, on the Virginia rally, and then on more abstract questions like private property, what makes something a right. So you're going to get a lot of both, it looks to me like. And that's a great combination. That's kind of what I try to maintain on this program as well. I want some stuff that keeps us up to date and some stuff that's evergreen. And that's looks to me like what you get at Dissecting Liberty. And the tagline is examining anarchism, of course, anarcho-capitalism, in the effort of discovering the best path to achieving individual liberty in a free society. So go check them out. You'll be supporting Tom Woods Show listeners at dissectingliberty.com. I'll link to that at tomwoods.com/1585. And as your weekend project, because we're approaching the weekend, just one more day, and then we'll be at the weekend, is to think about that website you've been wanting to start, and you think, I don't even know what to do. Well, I've got some information that'll show you how to be up and running with a blog in about 5 minutes. And then once you have that blog, if you've used my hosting link, then you're going to get free publicity from me and some other bonuses that will help make your rollout of your blog or your website as successful as it can possibly be. So get the details on all that at tomwoods.com/publicity, and I'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.